It's Sunday House Call with Dr. Barry Dworkin. If you have a medical question, call us at 521-TALK. That's 521-8255. Email sundayhousecall@cfra.com. Now here's Dr. Barry Dworkin.
Good afternoon and welcome to, I believe it's edition number 316 of Sunday House Call. And broadcasting live from the studios of News Talk Radio 580 CFRA here in Ottawa. And taking your calls at 521-TALK, 521-8255, star 580 on Bell Mobility. And if you happen to be listening further afield, 1-800-580-2372 is the number to call. All our lines are available, and I'm encouraging you to call in early, as always, so that I can get you on the air, answer your questions in full, and not have people waiting at the end, unfortunately, sometimes waiting 10, 15 minutes and having to say, sorry, we can't answer your question today because we've run out of time. We've only got about 15 minutes left in the show, so looking forward to your calls, 521-TALK, 521-8255, star 580 on Bell Mobility. And I wanted to cover a couple of issues today. It was interesting. I was having a conversation with a gentleman when I was at karate yesterday afternoon, and he's doing studies for Health Canada with regards to vaccines, but it was more along the lines of talking about causality. Now, before you turn off your radios, causality is one of those issues or one of those areas in news reporting, especially health news reporting, that invariably tends to be misrepresented. Classic examples are this nutrient comes out today, a study is done and says taking this produces that and gives you tremendous health benefits. When you look at the studies, there's nothing in there that really says that. And it's very common for people to make this normal association because we do this in our lives all the time. As human beings, our brains are trained to look for patterns. We love patterns. We love to make sense of the world. We try to fit things into our known perceptions of the world around us. And that's what our brains are designed to do. So when you're presented with, for example, and I've used this example before, many people saying, you know, when I got the flu shot, I got a cold. When there's nothing in the flu vaccine to give you a cold, in fact, there's no cold viruses in the flu vaccine and there's no active virus in the vaccine to begin with. And yet, invariably, people will believe, despite trying to explain to them that this is not what happens, they will believe that having been given the flu shot, that several days later when they get a cold, they therefore blame it on the flu shot. And this is a logical fallacy that's called post hoc ergo propter hoc, the fancy term that Carl Sagan used in his book, The Demon Haunted World, where he talks about in his baloney detection kit how easy it is to make false links or associations. So with regards to the flu shot, for example, suppose, and remember, flu shots are given during a time of year when a quarter of the population more or less has colds. And so it is very likely for you to catch a cold during this time. So I could give, say you had 100,000 people given flu vaccines around the same time, and lo and behold, 25,000 of them develop colds, which goes along with 1 in 4 people having a cold at any particular time during the winter or late fall and winter months. And I'd say, okay, instead of giving the flu shot, I'm going to give out 100,000 apples to each person. And would you believe, lo and behold, a week later, 25,000 of them will have colds. Now, you wouldn't say that the apple caused colds. No virus in the apple, no virus in the flu shot. But because it is an injection into the body and a medical procedure, the perception is, and people will, eating an apple is no big deal. People do that every day. Flu shots occur once a year. It's a sort of a minor difference in the normal routine or day-to-day routine that people have. And as a result, it becomes something that people pay attention to because it stands out from that particular day or that time during which flu shots are given. And so people end up saying, you know, it's because of that, that stands out because of that, therefore I've had a cold. And what brings me to bring this up is that there are there's an article written by Dr. Ben Goldacre just this past week, in fact yesterday, in The Guardian. And it had to do with, and it's entitled, Costly Life-Saving Drugs, You Have to Draw the Line Somewhere. And we've all faced this issue where an expensive medication comes out and there is somehow an association, you know, the drug is touted as helping someone, in this case with cancer. In this case, it's colon cancer, and the drug that was being discussed in this article is Avastin. And in these particular studies, what was concluded from the National Institute for Health and Clinical Excellence's recommendations was not to fund this particular drug in terms of bowel cancer because it costs about £21,000 a patient, meaning about $30,000 Canadian to do that. Because the clinical trials that were done, about 1,400 people that were done, they received chemotherapy with Avastin or chemotherapy with placebo and found that the average survival time extension when using Avastin was 19.9 months, went from 19.9 months without Avastin to 21.3 months with Avastin, so 6 weeks. But where this causality thing comes in was that the articles and the newspapers, as they reported this, put a specific spin. And they presented a story, and everybody loves stories. Stories captivate us. We empathize with people, especially when you're talking about one person. It's easier to empathize with one individual or a few individuals than with tens of thousands. And so in this case, this was the story of Barbara Moss, who was diagnosed with bowel cancer in 2006, had all the normal treatment, and paid out of her own pocket to have Avastin on top of that. And she's alive today, 4 years later. And so the inference is that because of telling the story this way, and arguably a more memorable story this way, it's now embedded in the minds of many people that have read this particular account, and that their conclusion is now, well, if I have Avastin for £21,000, I'm going to survive half a decade if I have colon cancer. But this is one person that stood out. What you really have to take into account is that regardless of that one person doing very well, the 19, almost 20 months normal survival versus 21.3 months with the Avastin was the average for many, many people. And just as you have some people who can smoke their entire lives and never get cancer, the majority of people who do smoke are going to get heart disease, lung cancer, various other cancers. That's just what happens. There's always outliers in this particular, in science. And so, again, associations, something is presented, people see Avastin, people see a woman that survives 4 years, 5 years, say, aha, the Avastin saved her for 4 or 5 years, therefore, for everybody, it's going to do that. And that's part of the problem with some of the reporting that we see today and some of the difficult decisions that are made, because it is gut-wrenching. It is difficult when you have people who are suffering, people who have severe diseases, who have terminal illnesses, and you're trying to make decisions on what to cover, what not to cover. But on the basis of the science, the 6 weeks of extra survival and the thousands of people that would be treated at £21,000, in this case, in the UK, they decided that money is better served to help others where there's longer survival times and not just 6 weeks. We have all lines available. Looking forward to your calls. I do not want to talk to myself for the next hour. I would rather have you call and ask some questions, comments, anything you would like to talk about. I know it's a gorgeous day outside, but someone must be listening. I'm Dr. Barry Dworkin. You're listening to Sunday House Call, and we'll be back in just a few minutes.
Dr. Barry Dworkin, Sunday House Call, News Talk Radio 580, CFRA.
Sunday House Call with Dr. Barry Dworkin is brought to you in part by Motion Specialties for all your home health care needs.
Now back to Dr. Barry Dworkin on 580 CFRA Sunday House Call. The numbers, 521-TALK, 521-8255.
And we're going straight to the phone lines as they are now filling up. And a good afternoon to Connie.
Hi
there.
Good afternoon, Dr. Horton. My question is, I have blood pressure, high blood pressure, and the medication 10 milligram Norvasc.
Norvasc, okay.
Yeah, before I use 5 milligram per day because the blood pressure still is high. So since this May, this year May, and start to double the dose. And lately, almost half month, I found my both leg that is swelling.
It's swelling up, yes.
And I think it should concern. Also, I have a little bit protein in my urine test.
Well, Norvasc or amlodipine, which is the generic name for it, is at greater doses, it can cause leg swelling. And so there are many other medications. If the leg swelling is causing a lot of problems or it's making it difficult, then there is, you know, there are many other solutions to control blood pressure. So it's not that you have to stay on this particular medication. There are other ones that can be substituted that will control your blood pressure very, very well.
Okay.
So what I would suggest is if you're noticing that there's a lot of swelling in your legs, especially since the increase in the Norvasc, you probably, I would see your physician, let them know that you're having a lot of the leg swelling. It's very straightforward to switch from one medication to another to keep your blood pressure under good control and not have to experience the leg swelling.
Oh, really?
Right.
And because I have difficulty for switch the medication, before I have almost, let me see, since 1998, I used, you know, I forgot the name. It's a water pill.
Pill. Probably hydrochlorothiazide or
2.5 milligram is. I suddenly forgot the water pill. When I change the medication, the blood pressure cannot come down, but. Before I use the water peeling, cause the problem is potassium level low.
Right.
I don't know what kind of the medication.
Yeah, you probably had hydrochlorothiazide or something along those lines too.
Yeah.
And that can cause
and,
some
dry mouth, those kind of medication.
But, but
so change the several medication, it doesn't work.
But Connie, there are many other kinds of medications that you haven't tried yet. And so,
do you suggest what kind to try?
Well, there are different classes of medications. So there's one class of medications.
Is it a water pill?
Well, no. What I would say is you should see your family doctor. There are different classes of medications. One is called ARBs. Another one's called ACE inhibitors. There are also different types of calcium channel blockers.
Uh-huh.
There are beta blockers. There are even angiotensin blockers. So there's different. There are different medications out there that you likely have not tried yet that should help to control your blood pressure. So you don't necessarily have to revert to ones you have taken before with regards to the water pill. Sometimes water pills at a much lower dose are used in combination with other blood pressure medications and they result in less loss of potassium and you don't have that problem anymore. You don't have as much of that problem. So what I would suggest, Connie, is again, with the swelling in your legs, you're having a side effect that, again, you don't have to have. There are other medications that you likely have not tried that will help control your blood pressure and remove that swelling that you've had in the legs.
Okay.
With regards to the protein that's in the urine, it is a matter of measuring kidney function. And there is a blood test and a urine test that is done to look at protein to see how well the kidneys are functioning. That test is called an ACR. Albumin creatinine ratio, or ACR.
ACR.
And that helps measure kidney function, and it tells you whether the kidneys have been damaged or not. And so that's a very easy test to do. And so those are the things that I would do. So I would speak to your doctor, ask to change the medications, use something you haven't used before, have some blood tests done as well to check kidney function with regards to the protein. But this is a very straightforward problem to correct.
Okay. So you think it's easy and the best way to change the medication.
Absolutely. There are many options available to you. This is not the end of the road with regards to options to control your blood pressure.
Not to stay with this medication, it causes a side effect like that.
That's right. If the leg swelling is distressing and you don't like the leg swelling, there certainly
are... Yeah, it's very uncomfortable.
Right. So there are other options available to you to correct that so you don't have the leg swelling but still have the blood pressure that's controlled.
If the family doctor doesn't want to change what
there's no reason why they shouldn't. It's a very straightforward and easy thing to do.
Okay.
All right. Well, Connie,
okay,
our lines are full. We have to go to the next caller.
Oh, but thank you very much.
You're very welcome.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye now. 521-TALK, 521-8255 is the number to call, and we do have one line available. And we are going to go to line 3, and good afternoon to Maureen.
Yes. Good afternoon, Dr. Dworkin. Hi, thank you. Avid listeners.
No, thank
and
you.
I wanted just to make a quick comment to your first comment about the drugs and being the wife of a kidney cancer survivor who, in most cases, these there were no options at the beginning. And the Avastin, my husband's not on Avastin, but on the drugs he's been on, he is here and right now doing his usual 2 hours on his treadmill and doing very well with the drugs that do cost a lot of money, and we are forever grateful for that. So the individual stories you were talking about does make a huge impression on all our family and friends, and sees a man who is still living and thriving. So my question actually was something completely different. I don't know where to get an answer about the BRAC gene saliva test for breast and ovarian cancer detection, and I'd like to know if you know.
Actually, I have no idea.
Okay.
No idea. I usually to check for the gene, they do a blood test and analyze the genome for that. They look for the gene that way. There is, I think, a test also. Likely any cells will pick that up. So if the gene is there, so swabs of the cheek and such are used for genetic testing as well. But I don't know of anything with regards to the test that you're mentioning. It's just not
so. Is that a test easily done? Does one have to ask for it from one's family doctor?
I think usually if there's a family history of breast cancer and there's concerns that the BRAC gene is involved, then it does mean that usually it's either through the cancer center or referral to an oncologist to do the testing in order to evaluate whether someone is at risk and then what they want to do with that result in terms of do they want to have mastectomies preemptively. What is it that they want to do ahead of time once they have that result? But usually it's more if there's a family history. You don't normally do testing for BRAC genes if there's no family history of breast cancer.
Okay, that makes sense. That's it. Thank you
all
very
right.
much.
You're very welcome, Maureen.
Bye-bye now.
521-TALK, 521-8255 is the number to call. And we're going to line 4, and good afternoon to Lee.
Hi, Dr.
Hi.
Dworkin.
How are you?
I'm very well. How are you?
I'm fine, thanks.
Good. I have a bit of a strange question for you, if you don't mind.
Go right ahead.
I'm just wondering if you can talk to me a little bit about any benefits or negatives to consuming honey as an alternative to sugar or sweetener. Is honey a good thing for you? Is it a bad thing for you? And is there a difference between pasteurized and non-pasteurized?
Well, the difference is between, if we deal with your last question, pasteurized versus unpasteurized. Yeah, the pasteurized destroys any harmful bacteria. Also, it also makes sure that there is no spores, botulinum spores. So
okay.
You can get botulism from unpasteurized honey. So that's why honey is normally pasteurized. With regards to sugar versus honey, in terms of what it actually will do, it's exactly the same thing. Honey is just another form of sugar. It tastes better. Some people like it better. And again, anything in moderation. If you're going to use honey and add it to your tea, or you want to add it to your iced tea, or you want to put it in a peanut butter sandwich, big deal. You know, it's fine. But in terms of looking at the difference nutrition-wise between honey and sugar, no major difference. They are both simple sugars. They're both absorbed readily. They both will do exactly the same thing to blood sugar levels. So in that regard, no difference. But again, I don't see very many people dumping cups of honey into their bowls of cereal or into their tea. They usually use a spoonful or a small amount. Whereas when you look at how regular refined sugar is used nowadays, it's in everything and in much greater quantities. So from that standpoint, when you look at a specific food, you're probably seeing a lot more refined sugar in foods than you are with regards to honey, although honey is added into some foods from time to time. But again, to answer your question, no difference nutritionally. It is more just a decision if you want to have some honey. Again, in moderation, no big deal. If you're adding in, you know, if you're going through a liter of honey a week or every 2 weeks, that's a lot of sugar and a lot of calories.
Oh, sure.
So,
sure.
But otherwise, no. I mean, a little bit from time to time is again, it's always moderation.
Well, that's great. Thanks,
all right.
Dr. Dworkin.
You're very welcome, Lee. Bye-bye now. 521-TALK, 521-8255 is the number to call. Star 580 on Bell Mobility. And if you're outside the area, 1-800-580-2372. And we do have two lines available. And when we do come back, coming up next, we have Tracy in Newlington, wants to talk about vertigo with regards to relief from vertigo and questions. Doug in Ottawa has a question about shortness of breath and the cause. Lauren in Montreal about hand pain and carpal tunnel syndrome question. And Jim in Ottawa, problems with phlegm and some suggestions about that. But we do have two other lines available, 521-TALK, 521-8255, star 580 on Bell Mobility. I'm Dr. Barry Dworkin. You're listening to Sunday House Call. Back in just a few minutes.
580 CFRA Sunday House Call, your weekly checkup with Dr. Barry Dworkin. Call us at 521-TALK, 521-8255, or email the doctor, sundayhousecall@cfra.com.
Sunday House Call with Dr. Barry Dworkin is brought to you in part by livinghealthychamplain.ca, helping you take control of your health.
The advice and recommendations in this program are for general educational purposes and not a diagnosis. You should consult a physician or health professional directly before beginning or changing any course of health treatment. Now back to Dr. Barry Dworkin on 580 CFRA Sunday House Call. The numbers, 521-TALK, 521-8255.
And over to Newlington and Tracy. Good afternoon.
Hi there.
Hi.
How are you?
I'm fine. How are you?
I'm fine. I can't believe I'm calling, but I love your show.
Thank you.
Yeah, I just want to know about vertigo. I had it years and years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And then it only affected me when I was lying down.
Mm-hmm.
So I basically had to sit up for a couple of weeks when I went to sleep.
Right.
And then it passed. I did go to the hospital, actually, at that point, because I had a brain tumor or something, and he said, no, it's just a virus. Mm-hmm. It'll pass. But I've had it again, and now I've had it since the last week of July. And it's much worse than it used to be, and I get nauseous, and it just kind of started on its own when I was doing sit-ups one day.
Okay.
And I've been doing these exercises that I see on the internet. You go on one side, then you go on the other, and they seem to help, but it gets a little better, and then it comes back. So I don't know what to do.
Okay. Well, with regards to vertigo, it's important to try to determine what the cause is, what's the actual mechanism of the disease or the state that's leading to that. Most mm-hmm. commonly, the most common cause of vertigo is something called benign paroxysmal positional vertigo. All that means is that it starts suddenly. That's what paroxysmal mm-hmm. means. It starts suddenly, and it depends on your body position. So someone that is the way our balance organ works, the balance organs on both sides of our head, first of all, they're very tiny. They are formed of three half circles, or what's called semicircular canals. Sort of, if you think of a cube, right? Three-dimensional cube.
Uh-huh.
And when you're giving dimensions of the cube, it's length, width, and height, right?
Uh-huh.
Well,
yeah.
each of those semicircular canals or tubes that form the balance organs also are in that direction. One goes up and down, one goes side to side, and one goes in and out. So you have three dimensions. So
mm-hmm.
so what this does is that, for example, you may find that turning your head side to side doesn't make you as dizzy as moving your head up and down, or vice versa.
Mm-hmm.
And that helps determine which tube or canal happens to be affected or blocked. And that's sort of the mechanism behind that kind of vertigo. And the exercises you were mentioning, or the head position or head turning things, what's called the Epley maneuvers, this is designed to try to dislodge a tiny crystal that forms sometimes in these tubes and blocks the normal activity or function of the tube. So your brain ends up not getting the signal that identifies correctly where you've turned your head Your eyes tell you one thing, but the change in body position tells your brain something else, and you get dizzy or nauseated as a result of that.
Mm-hmm.
This type of condition can last up to 6 weeks and does tend to resolve on its own. There are medications that are available to help alleviate the vertigo that work reasonably well. But but other than that, though, there are other things that can cause dizziness and that can cause vertigo. There's inflammation of the nerve that goes to the ear in terms of the balance organs. There's Meniere's disease. There's inner ear infections or middle ear infections. There's a whole host of different things that can cause this problem.
Mm-hmm.
And so ideally, you would probably want to have this evaluated, especially if it's not going away. If it's now, we're now looking at 4 weeks that you've had this at least.
Yeah.
And if it's not getting any better, if you find that it's still at the same level, you're still getting nauseated, sometimes an evaluation by a neurologist is very helpful because you do want to identify what the cause is of the vertigo, because there's so many different things that can do it, many of which you likely do not have. But the point is that you're having this happen. It's not getting any better. And it's happened once before. And that, again, goes along to it being benign positional vertigo. But nevertheless, it's still something that should be evaluated just to make sure that there's nothing else that we're not missing the boat on anything else.
Okay. So I guess I'll have to go and see my doctor.
Yeah, especially if you're not using anything for the vertigo, there is something that works really. It does work reasonably well. It won't make you drowsy. You don't get hooked on it. And it does help. It's called beta histine is the name of it. And it does help alleviate a lot of the dizziness and nausea that can occur from this particular condition.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, Dr. Dworkin.
Oh, you're very welcome, Tracy.
Have a nice day.
Thanks, you too.
Thanks.
Bye now. 521-TALK, 521-8255 is the number to call. And we're going to go to line 7 and Montreal. And good afternoon to Lauren.
Yeah, hi. How are you, doctor?
I'm fine. How are you?
Good, thank you. I have a question for you. Over the last couple of years, a little bit more than 2 years ago, I started having a little bit of pain in my hand.
Mm-hmm.
The pain is really in the, let's say, the fatty part of the thumb, below the thumb, between the thumb and the wrist.
Okay.
On my left hand. I've been working out for years, and I've been doing push-ups for years and years. I know that both of my folks had problems with their carpal tunnel syndromes years ago. And I've noticed that now not only do I have it in my right hand, but I seem to have also left hand. I seem to have also developed it in my right hand, and it's pretty well at the early stages as it was on the other one. On the left hand too, what I've noticed is that now it not only is it in the particular area that I mentioned, but now it also on occasion goes around to the knuckle part, if you wish, of the lower knuckle of the thumb.
Mm-hmm.
And at times, it can get in the way. It is painful. It can be rather painful at times, and it can get in the way myself being able to properly grip. Not that I can, but it's painful when I do. Especially the left hand.
Mm-hmm.
But from what I read with carpal tunnel syndrome, though, I never get the entire hand going numb.
Right.
The only time that my hand ever goes numb is I've noticed I sleep and I have my hands on my chest. And my hands are elevated.
Mm-hmm.
Then my hands would get a little bit numb, but that's about it.
Okay. Well, what you're describing, there are two avenues that need to be determined. One is this neurological? That is it a nerve that is being compressed or squeezed from the activities that you're doing? Or is this musculoskeletal? That is there tissue that has been damaged, compressed, a bone that may have cracked, that is leading to this pain? Because what you're describing, and you're absolutely correct, Lauren, in that usually the neurological problem from carpal tunnel syndrome would result in more than just the area of the thumb that you mentioned being either numb or painful. And that area, by the way, the name of that area is called the thenar eminence. And so that you would usually suspect that if the carpal tunnel or the median nerve, which runs into the wrist, was being compressed, you would expect there to be that not only the thumb, but the index finger, the middle finger and half of the fourth finger be feeling a bit numb, with pain that sometimes would wake you up at night radiating up to your shoulder. And people tend to shake their hands when they wake up at night in order to alleviate the numbness and pain. But from what you're describing, especially if you're you said you're lifting weights, I believe.
No,
push-ups.
I do. I just do push-ups.
Right.
I do mostly resistance-type training.
Okay.
A little bit of weights, but not very much.
Well, it's quite straightforward to figure out what's going on. The first is we want to make sure that we're not missing the boat on any maybe stress fracture in some of the tiny bones around that area. And so an X-ray of the hand would help determine that. That's a very easy way to make sure, because what we're trying to do is making a list of the things that could be doing this and then scratching off that list as results come in. So on that list, you do still have carpal tunnel, which is possible. You have a possible peripheral nerve compression, so not necessarily the main nerve running in, but a branch of that nerve. You have potential bone trauma. You have potential muscle or tendon damage. All those things are on that list. So the way to eliminate bone as one of them is doing an X-ray. Another way to eliminate the nerve itself is to do what's known as a nerve conduction study, or an EMG, electromyogram, but nerve conduction study is the same thing. And that will determine if there is any part of the nerve that's being compressed or damaged. It will detect a slowing down of electrical propagation or conduction through the nerve at that point where it is compressed. And that also helps make a diagnosis of whether, again, there's a neurological component. So, for example, if you do a nerve conduction study and it shows that the nerve is conducting things beautifully all the way down your hand, you now have eliminated any neurological problem. And then you're left with really, and if we assume the bone is okay, then you're left with actual tissue itself that is damaged, because that's all you really have in the hand is bone, muscle, ligaments, tendons, blood supply, and nerve. And so if you eliminate as you go along and eliminate those things, you're going to be left with musculoskeletal if those other things are okay. And then you're looking at rehab or something to try to, or even reducing the stress on your hands from the push-ups, stopping the push-ups or doing a different kind of resistance training to try to alleviate some of the pressure in that area. So that's sort of a stepwise approach. So in terms of what it is, there's a list, and now it's a matter of seeing your physician and saying, okay, this is the problem. Can we check this out and do each of these areas to try and figure out which one of those areas is what's responsible for this pain that I'm having?
That's great. And you were saying that area is called?
The thenar eminence, T-H-E-N-A-R. Thenar, that's the fatty area you mentioned right on the pad of the hand near the thumb.
Yes.
And the one that's on the other side of the hand, sort of below the fifth finger, you know, the fatty area on that area, is called the hypothenar eminence. All right.
Super. Well, listen, thank you very much for your help.
You're very welcome.
Always enjoy it, eh?
Thank you.
Have a good day.
You too. We're going to take a small break, and when we come back, Doug in Ottawa has been waiting a little bit of time. Then we have Jim, Sarah, and Ellen. I'm Dr. Barry Dworkin. You are listening to Sunday House Call. Back with your calls in just a couple of minutes.
Dr. Barry Dworkin, Sunday House Call, News Talk Radio 580, CFRA.
Sunday House Call with Dr. Barry Dworkin is brought to you in part by Motion Specialties for all your home health care needs.
Sunday House Call with Dr. Barry Dworkin is brought to you in part by LivingHealthyChamplain.ca, helping you take control of your health.
Now back to Dr. Barry Dworkin on 580 CFRA Sunday House Call. The numbers 521-TALK, 521-8255.
And over to line two, and Doug in Ottawa. Good afternoon. How are you?
Perhaps your answers will tell me.
Okay.
About October, November last year, I was complaining to my GP about shortness of breath, no stamina, muscle aching in my legs. I was referred to a cardiologist at the Heart Institute. Mm-hmm. Test included PET and concluded with the catheterization. And at the end of that exercise on the operating table, a cardiologist said to me, Mr. XYZ, your arteries are completely clear.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I said, that's good news, but how do we fix this problem? Well, there was some muttering, and then it said, well, maybe it's your lungs. So I've been referred to a respirologist, two chest x-rays, CT chest scan, which indicate my lungs are clear.
Mm-hmm.
And now there's some muttering about, well, maybe I have asthma. Well, I'm a super senior. Is that possible at post 65 that you can get or come down with asthma?
really, it's rare to see that unless someone has a long-standing history of smoking.
No, none of that.
But if you don't smoke, then it's rare to see that happen. I mean, it can, with exposure to certain environmental things or pollutants, sometimes cause shortness of breath. Does this happen when you are at rest or if you're exerting yourself?
Oh, it's when I go to the OAC with a senior group, and I notice my capacity to do the exercises is quite a ways down. So by the time I walk from the gym to my car, I'm puffing.
Okay. So it's really a fatigue factor. There's just the endurance is not there anymore.
Yes, and quite a bit now of napping in the afternoon and evening.
Okay. Well, there are some key things that you've mentioned that are very important that have eliminated a lot of possibilities. One, we know from a cardiac standpoint, your heart is great. We know from a lung standpoint, that's functioning well. Are there any treatments that you're receiving now, any medications that you're taking at the moment for any conditions?
Just a blood pressure pill and half a water pill.
Okay.
And I can't think of it, another blood pressure medication.
Okay. Now, for the blood pressure pills, do you happen to know what the names are or what kinds they are?
I can pry them out if we have time, and I can tell you precisely. But
well, because the reason is that there is one class of blood pressure medication that can cause fatigue, especially in older folks. They're beta blockers, so things like atenolol, metoprolol, those are common ones that are used when treating blood pressure. They sometimes can cause fatigue and reduced exercise capacity because it doesn't let your heart rate move up, doesn't let your heart beat faster. So
one of the things I'm using is Covercell, but that's been about 4 years.
Yeah.
But my GP did make the remark once about the beta blockers that cardiologists love them and gerontologists hate them.
Right.
Because a gerontologist patient were coming and complaining about, you know, lack of poop and that.
And also, again, if you do not have a history of heart disease, then beta blockers for the treatment of blood pressure is not necessarily the one you would want to use. There are other ones that would tend to reduce that would minimize fatigue that the beta blockers cause. But that being said, there's still something else that needs to be evaluated. Again, it's on the basis of age, and there is still, in terms of evidence for this, it's still up in the air, but it's still worthwhile to evaluate. And that is, in men, as they get older, levels of testosterone tend to diminish over time. And as a result of that, you can get muscle weakness, reduced exercise capacity, and shortness of breath because of those other factors. And there are other things that have to be looked at as well. So you have testosterone, you have thyroid function, if that hasn't been done yet, checking for your thyroid gland to see how well that's working. But in the end, it's a blood test that's done. The blood test that is done for thyroid is very straightforward. Your family doctor can do that, as well as ordering a blood test called a free testosterone level. And that also will indicate whether, if it's in the normal range, great. If it's not in the normal range and it's quite low and you're having symptoms and you have had a workup to eliminate heart effects, lung effects, your kidneys are working fine, there's really nothing else that has been determined as a contributing factor. If, for example, you're on beta blockers and your physician changes you from beta blockers to something else and your blood pressure is still well controlled and you're still feeling tired without endurance, and a blood test comes back and says, you know, thyroid's okay, but testosterone level's too low, or testosterone level is normal and thyroid level is too low, those can be corrected. There are medications, for example, for thyroid that will replace thyroid hormone, and that work very well. And for testosterone, if that happens to be low, and again, we're just making assumptions, but it's just something to evaluate. If testosterone is low, there is testosterone that can be taken by prescription that will increase the level. And what tends to happen, if indeed that is what the cause is reverses a lot of the problems with regards to muscle weakness and endurance.
I'm due for an annual physical, and I have a requisition for blood tests.
Mm-hmm.
Would any of those be a standard item, or do I have to get my GP to request them specifically?
Your family doctor or GP can easily order those. Again, it's called the free testosterone, and the other one is a TSH, which is the thyroid test.
Okay.
And that can be done, and it's a straightforward blood test. It's done with all the other blood tests that are ordered, and that would go a long way, at least to answer the question. I'm not saying this is what you have, but at the same time, you've already gone through a bunch of stuff that says what you haven't, what you don't have, but you're still feeling this way.
Yeah,
and it's interfering with your quality of life. It's interfering with your ability to function. And so that is a very straightforward, relatively painless way to find out whether indeed that is a possibility. If it's not, well, at least you know, and then we move on to the next thing. But those would be the two things from what you've described, because when I saw what the problem was, I made my list of things beforehand. Lung problems, COPD, asthma, pneumonia, heart problems, kidney. And then I had endocrinological, which is thyroid and testosterone function. And so you've eliminated a few of them already. Mm-hmm. It looks like the next step is looking at hormones, in this case, thyroid hormone and testosterone.
I think you've been very thorough, Anson, and I thank you for that. And I think you're pointing me in a direction that we should find a resolution fairly soon.
And let us know, Doug. Let us know what happens.
Okay.
All right.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Bye-bye now. And another person who's been waiting quite a long time, Jim from Ottawa. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Hi.
How are you?
I'm fine. How are you?
Not too bad. I have a problem. I have a problem with phlegm.
Yes.
In the bottom of my throat, and it's a 24/7 problem.
Mm-hmm.
I can every time I cough up phlegm in the middle of the night, in the morning, before I go to sleep. How do I control this phlegm?
Okay, so rapid questions I'm going to ask you. Any smoking history?
No.
Okay. Has this been evaluated so far with regards to cause? Has anybody looked at this problem yet?
I asked my doctor about it, and the only answer I got was, your lungs are clear.
Okay, so this is what I want you to do, Jim, in terms of when you speak to your physician, because the phlegm in the back of your throat can be due to gastric reflux, that is acid that comes up from your stomach. You don't necessarily have to have heartburn, but it can irritate the back of your throat, that causes mucus production, which can cause the phlegm to occur. It can also be in terms of airway irritation, could be compounds in the air, things irritating the airway that cause mucus secretion. So things like asthma, not necessarily asthma, but the mechanisms that can cause asthma, allergy-related things can do that as well. Exposure to compounds can do that as well. So that's another component. Sinus congestion or postnasal drip. You may or may not have that, but again,
I do have it.
And that can cause phlegm in the back of the throat as well. So if you're having sinus congestion, there are things that can be used to alleviate sinus congestion and reduce the inflammation that leads to the drip that falls in the back of the throat, that then the water evaporates, leaving you with a more thicker mucusy stuff in the back of the throat. So those are three things just off the top of my head, because we only have 30 seconds left in the show.
Right.
Three things off the top of my head that can certainly be causing this. So I would go back to your doctor, say, fine, my lungs are clear. Now let's look at my stomach, the acid, my nose, and potentially allergies that could be contributing to this.
Will do.
All right, Jim.
Thanks a lot.
You're very welcome. My apologies to Sarah, Ellen, and Bruce. We've unfortunately run out of time. If you can call in next week, we'll be able to answer your questions right away and get you on right away. Thanks to Phil Godreau, technical producer for Sunday House Call. And once again, your calls always appreciated and your support of the show truly appreciated. We'll be back again next week with another edition of Sunday House Call. I'm Dr. Barry Dworkin. Have a great week.